agreement to rebase Proposition 98. And I want to thank the educational leaders for being such great partners in our California recovery. Even with this rebasing, kindergarten through 12th grade spending will grow by $216 per child per year. But we also improve the quality of education by how we spend our money. My budget will shift more spending authority to local school districts. This budget will make reductions. And this is a very difficult decision that I do not take lightly. As I said in my State of the State address, if we do not control the spending today, we will put every program at risk tomorrow, and California will be bankrupt. And a bankrupt California will not be able to provide services to anyone. As you can see on this slide, my budget makes us live within our means. And that's exactly what I promised during my campaign, that when I become governor of this state, I will not spend more money than the state takes in. In the past, this was a house divided and conquered. The problems became bigger than the ability to overcome them. But that was then. But now we have proven that we can work together side by side, removing the partisan baggage that held everyone back. Already the legislature joined with me to put my California recovery plan on a March ballot. I know every member of the legislature has good intentions. They all are interested to make this a better state. If we work together, we can show to the people of California that we are worthy their trust. Together, the legislature and I will take California out of the poorhouse and make it once again a powerhouse. I believe with all my heart that we can turn this state around and make it once again the greatest state of the greatest country in the world. Thank you. And now, before I ask Don Odwin, my genius, my director of finance, to come out here and to tell you more the details about our budget, I'm more than happy to answer.
Shut the hell up, Arnold. All this talk about if we work together, we can show people that we're worthy of their trust. Look, fool, get the money back from the electrical, privatized, deregulated energy pirates like Enron and stuff. Oh, no, whoa. You can't do that because that's part of your master system. And then you babble out. We also improve the quality of education and how we spend our money. My budget will shift more money to local school districts. In other words, you'll send it like to this school and power to like this school in Oakland who's trying to close down as many public schools as possible. And of course, replace them with privatized voucher system ones. And then you yap. I want to thank the educational leaders in the California recovery. What recovery, fool? The damn state's billions of dollars in debt. Schools are closing. Mad cow meat is running amok and no one even knows where the damn meat is. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world's slave revolt time. Tonight, we're going to examine how and what is the plight for the Iraqi sisters in Iraq since the U.S. imperialist invasion has hit home. in Iraq. Then we're going to have Gerald kick it off with the Making It Plain news update. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Oh, you apologies, no appendages. I am an African, and this is not my home. My home is in Africa. My village is in Africa. My nation is simply Africa. I am an African, and this is not my home. Africa.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the shadow. You know, there's much yippity-doo-dah rhetoric by the rulers in their corporate media outlets that Sam is bringing democracy to Iraq. Now, never mind the fact that you can't really bring democracy from the outside. And Sam's version of democracy, well, if a school of the America Empire believes in democracy in the third world, then, you know, Hitler was a humanitarian. But what we're going to deal with is some of the issues that women are now facing and how that does or does not fit into Sam's vision, and or concern about the democratic process. So first off, let's deal with this sister, Yasar Muhammad. She's the founder of an organization of called Women for Freedom, Organization of Women Freedom. She's also the editor-in-chief of Al-Mazawat, which means equality. So here she talks about how women's rights are being influenced by Sam and his G.I. Joe invaders since they have stepped their cowboy boots into Iraqi soil. So let's check out what she has to say, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
The story that does not reach to this part of the world is how the women are treated in the post-war Iraq. What happened to us, how our, let's say, destinies were totally devastated by this war. What is told to everybody is that we got rid of a bloody dictator, which is a true story. But the part that nobody knows about is that we did have sort of a secure life. We did have our jobs. We did have some stability that we totally lost with the first day of the war. Now, our everyday life has abductions for women. We cannot go out in the streets safely. We are immediately a moving target on the streets, and we qualify for kidnappings, for rape and for killing just because we are women. And on top of all of that, what the coalition did was hand over part of the authorities to religious fundamentalists that turned our lives to push us hundreds of years back in time. We are pushed back to the spot where my grandmother was, and that's not where we want to be. Women in Iraq have been educated. They've had access to work for more than half a century now. It's something that we will not do without anymore. They go into our schools now. They force the women into veil, and you look at the streets, the women are not safe to be out in the streets. This is our reality in the post-war Iraq, and these are the freedoms and the democracy that we testify now in Baghdad.
All right, so here you have this sister, Yasar, talking about, Yanar, talking about how these basic rights have been eroded, and everything that Sam is doing has nothing to do with constructing or protecting any type of human rights, because of course Sam is not over there for that. Sam had no concern when Saddam, their little Frankenstein monster that they helped create, was, you know, acting a fool towards just about anyone in his wake. So of course, now under these new conditions, when they're trying to put together their new form of imperialist strategy, they're not concerned with the plight of women. And quite often, women find themselves at the brunt of the destruction of these particular types of wars. Now, you know, you had an outbreak because of the collapse of much of the social order, an outbreak of these little thugs running around and who are not fighting the imperialists. They're preying upon the people. You had not too long ago this one sister named Rabba. She was in a Toyota. She was driving with her fiance, and they get carjacked. And the carjackers decided that they were going to make her part of the addition to the carjacking. And they decided that they were going to rape her in the back seat, and she thrust herself out of the car. Her fiancé and her brother went to the cops to report not her being attempted to be raped, but the car being stolen. That's what they were concerned about. So things have already gotten demented from all angles. And now, basically, her relationship with her fiancé is kind of just been warped out. I mean, he's not even really responding to her. Like somehow she's tainted because some nuts try to rape her. You know, all this fake honor. You know, so here you have a situation where Sam has helped unleash these kind of desperate and thuggish type forces. And then you have this, you know, backwards concept of, you know, your honor and manhood being ripped from you because your girl was assaulted by some punks and stuff like that. And where is Sam in all of this? Trying to protect the oil fields and privatize as much of the economy of Iraq as possible.
Well, actually, there's a lot to discuss on the question of Iraqi women and the Middle East, because here is a fact that unfortunately many of our American citizens are simply not aware of. In the barrage of disinformation to kind of hornswoggle the American people to go to war and approve the war and support the war, it has been missed that in fact the position, the social and economic position of Iraqi women was far superior to that of most women in the Middle East. Tracy talks about, you know, what do you say, the House of Saad, the Wahhabi, this Wahhabi perversion of Islam. We're talking about Saudi Arabia, where I think they shot a princess because she gave up the poo-poo, because she had a little fun. They shot her or cut her head off of some old madness. Now, that was law. I'm talking about legally. I'm not talking about some crazy person go and did it to her, or some distraught member of her family.
Yeah, they often stone people who, you know, commit adultery and all of that stuff.
This still, I mean, today, we're not talking about...
They modernized it today, because now what they do is they put you in a body bag first, and then they get a dump truck and have the dump truck dump all the rocks on you.
Oh, it's not as messy. You don't have to see the agony.
Right, right.
And but anyway, so actually the truth of the matter is that Iraqi women were generally in a far better economic and social position in Iraq than most other countries in the Middle East. This is not, you know, nobody jumping on the Saddam bandwagon. This is just a fact of life. We have to deal with this. And when Tracy talked about this honor thing is serious. It might sound bizarre that they didn't mention the rape thing, but particularly the Arabic world, and not exclusively in the Arabic world, there have been honor killings. A woman gets raped, and then somebody in the family kill her. Because you spoiled, you ruined, you bad goods. Or if she had some sex out of wedlock. They say, well, hell, I can't get no bride price out of your ass now. You got to go. This false consciousness has led to a number of honor killings. Killings, where they kill the women I'm talking about. So, and she said they've been put back 100 years, but it ain't over, sister. Let's see what unfolds.
All right. Next off, Yanar talks about some of the things that she tried to do within the U.S. coalition. You know, that's, you know, with Chalabi and all of those guys that they put together in Iraq for women. So she's gone to these forces to see what she could try to work out for women since these thugs are there, knowing that they're thugs. But let's see what she has to say on this. Check it.
I try to be part of the women women conferences that the coalition supervised. And they said that they want to make the voices of the Iraqi women heard. But I was surprised that because I was having demands of equality between women and men, of a constitution that becomes secular, that is based on this equality, I was rejected in this conference. When I went to the coalition asking for support for women's organizations, for a first women's shelter in Baghdad, I reminded them of their responsibilities to keep the securities for women on the streets. I had very set demands, and all I found was deaf ears, nobody who was willing to respond in any way. And for the financial support, they told me, you can go talk to NGOs. When I reminded them that this is more than half the Iraqi population I'm talking about, and the resources should be directed to us before anywhere else, I was told, these are the emails of the NGOs. You can talk to them. They are very good in that. Top officials. One of them was Stephen Spears. He was the first consultant for the future Ministry of Social Affairs, Labor and Social Affairs. And he was supposed to be responsible for whatever programs are for women. And I did ask him, I told him, look, if you claim that you are bringing us democracy to Iraq, American democracy, how about you give us some of the democracy that was gained by the working class of America, the achievements that they had here, the feminists, what they got in America. For example, the social insurance, the benefits, that's what we need in Baghdad and in Iraq right now, especially because this war had made millions of people jobless, and they have no source of income. And let's talk about the hundreds of thousands of widows who have children and no source of income. How are they supposed to survive one more day after 13 years of sanctions and two of the most fierce wars? They need, let's say, a minimum of an emergency fee right away to be able to survive. He looked at me and he made a presentation of how tired he was because he's left his family back home, and how much effort he was putting into setting up a government that could take some time. After setting up the government, they'll make a census from north to south in Iraq, and then they will decide who to give the benefits and the social insurance to. Then he looked at me and he said, did you have social insurance in Saddam's times? And that was a surprise for me. I told him, are you trying to equal Saddam's, the Ba'ath regime times for us? Is that what we're trying to do here? And he was pissed off with the whole thing that I was asking for, and his final announcement was, are you here to collaborate or to confront? So, you know, women's groups in Iraq, people would think that all the world is looking at us and everybody wants to help. But I knocked all doors in order to get help, and I did not get any.
That's a damn shame. All right, well, look, we cannot have any illusions about this matter. It appears that the Iraqi people and that damn sand, in, you know, sand with a D, is simply in the way of Sam with the M getting his oil. That's all. They're just a minor inconvenience. Actually, y'all, as I said before, the position of women in Iraq was better. See, there's something in the Middle East that's common. It's called the veil. In Iraq, this became an actual political matter that fed into and fueled the growth of the Mujahideen. When I say the veil, some people think about some kind of a little harem situation where somebody got a little transparent, little nylon thing they keep over their face while they ain't got no clothes on and they do the hula hula. No, baby, we ain't talking about that. It be hot in these countries, and the veil is means, really, covering the chador, covering yourself from head to toe, period. For instance, in Iraq, and I'm sorry, in Afghanistan, there was a nut that went around throwing acid in the face of any woman that didn't have a veil on.
You're talking about wearing burqas.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Thank you. You know, that's how serious this shit gets. So when we have, they're trying to put the veil back on the women, but more importantly, having destroyed the economic infrastructure, they saying, look, you know, somebody else will take care of it. Somebody, that's hypocrisy, because they love to talk about the women like they're going to do some good for them. But in order to do some good for them, they'd have to have a different economic approach. And that ain't happening.
And also, like, if you look, let's look what happened in Afghanistan. You know, I know it's not on the front pages anymore because the corporate media and much of the U.S. population's 10-minute, you know, span of attention is kind of up. But you've had situations where, the interim leader, Hamad Karzai, you know, the guy, Sam, is back. You know, he announced his own election as president before the actual vote was taken. So, you know, here, this, and now they're already popping up Chalabi as being the prime candidate or one of the prime rulers and all of this type of stuff. You know, the whole thing's a farce. Then, Minister of Women's Affairs, Sami Samar, when Boy George was doing one of his, you know, State of the Union type of addresses, he put forth this person as a committed person to women's rights in Afghanistan. But, of course, this person who did talk about some women's rights issues and stuff like that, it went unnoticed to the corporate media that this person was basically ran out of Dodge by the little hardline fundamentalists. He said, no, we ain't going for that. So you've had all of these forms of intimidation going on and things like that. In the meantime, you had the re-empowerment of various officials in the Northern Alliance and all of that type of stuff. And the U.S. State Department's envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's also a former Unocal oil executive and who's worked hand in glove with the Karzai and the Northern Alliance, they've been manipulating votes behind the various scenes and stuff. One incident was there was a lot of support for the elected former king, Zahir Shah, to be the head of state. Then what Khalilzad did was they delayed the start of the proceedings for 2 days while the king, former king, was strong-armed into pulling his name from consideration. So here's someone that had been known in the region. And then when all of this type of stuff was apparently opening up for people to have positions, they knew this person and they were voting for him. And then, but this was not the person that Sam wanted. So they hold up the whole election process and then get some of their little thugs and basically get him to say, oh, all right, I'm not running for office now. I'll pull my name, withdraw my name. And then, of course, their little thugs that they are backing will win. This is the, you know, my whole point in mentioning this is that, see, many of the things that are already taking place in Afghanistan is what Sam is trying to engineer in Iraq right now. All one has to do is just look across a few borders, and you'll see that Sam's up to his same old traditional tricks. So for them to play off currently like they're trying to bring democracy to Iraq when they're viciously setting up the same type of apparatus that they've already got more deeply rooted in Afghanistan right now, this brings the fraud to their whole game plan to light. And you have a sister like Yanar, who's, you know, a decent person trying to basically protect women. That's all. And she's in a very vulnerable situation to the point where, you know, Gerald, she has to have bodyguards. She's packing all the time now and has bodyguards because she has these little right-wing nuts trying to kill her on one hand. And then, as you heard, you got these little punk U.S. Imperialists mad at her and all impatient with her and stuff like that on the other hand. So she's trapped. And,
but they did have the conference.
Right. With these psychopaths on all sides.
Man.
Now, next, let's hear Yanar talk about how the U.S. Coalition forces have helped polarize the people in Iraq into these little baskets. Check this out.
We have forwarded this political formula that sets the dividing lines between the people, between the working class, set upon ethnicity, set upon religions, and I would say also on gender. They have established the divisions between the Iraqis now, and these divisions have had the results already showing the beginnings of civil war between differing sects just because they are of different religions. In the time that 20 years back, nobody cared what your religion was, what my religion was. But during these, especially during the last decade after the isolation from the international community, and also Saddam had a role here in the Islamization of the society, in pushing people back to these old thinking of my ID is my religion. There was no more working class struggle. There was no more feminist struggle. And all the society is living in this vacuum where political Islam has done his attack on Iraq as well as many countries in the area. And you know what? This attack on Iraq has established this reality that the Iraqi people now are being sandwiched between the state terrorism that we see coming from the U.S. administration and the other side of terrorism, which is political Islam and their notorious groups.
Wow. Well, ain't nothing to be said right there. She done broke it down proper.
Right. And see, part of the reason why this whole emergence of, as she calls, a political Islam has had roots is because the U.S. has played a fundamental role in creating a lot of these political Islamists against the left and the working class. And through that process, you know, like in Afghanistan, the whole aspect of the ISI in Pakistan, them funding and backing and training them. Then you have the Wahhabis out of Saudi Arabia, who were helped finance a lot of this type of stuff. And the Wahhabis in the House of Saud have created a lot of these strict Islamist sects all throughout the Middle East. And they finance all these schools for that form of teaching and on and on and on. And a lot of these countries are in dire situation. So they have these networks where they're coming in, giving food and other things, but at the same time, they're setting up these little fundamentalist social orders, not that different than what Boy George and them are trying to do with some of this right-wing Christian stuff when they want to set up these schools that help, that get funding from the public, but they also are able to teach, you know, some of this little Christian rhetoric and stuff like that. They're trying to indoctrinate portions of the population with this type of stuff. And the whole Wahhabi thing is, you know, this ultra a puritanical form of, you know, Islam that regulates various forms of a daily life. Under, like in Saudi Arabia, adulterers are beheaded, thieves have their hands amputated. Now, one of the guys who's put in power now in Afghanistan, where the Taliban reign, he talks about, well, now if a woman leaves her husband, we don't kill her. We just throw her in prison for 3 or 4 months. So it's a softer form of Sharia interpretation or whatever, you know. So, I mean, this is, but see, this is, Sam has no problems with this. This is what I'm saying.
Well, no, they're hypocritical on that too, Tracy, because originally they said they were not going to tolerate an Islamic Republic in, you know, Afghanistan. Originally, Cheney, a whole lot of them said that. And I just said, okay, well, man, let's see. Well, now we see. Because that is, in fact, what is happening. Their constitution is Islamic-based.
Right.
I'm talking about Afghanistan.
Right.
So they were hypocrites, liars again.
Well, they've been hypocrites
again.
You know, on down the line, that recent report that just came out the other day. I'm talking about the Carnegie Endowment report, which basically criticized the Boy George administration and said that they systematically misrepresented the facts about Iraq as far as weapons of mass destruction, links to Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. The whole thing was a sham. They recently had on, what's that Negro's name? Colin Powell. And he was shucking and jiving and all embarrassed and stuff, tap dancing all over the place. Because basically they said everything all y'all did was made up. You know it. And the cat's out of the bag. You know, they did a little independent research. This type of stuff we've been talking about. But now, Boy George and them have come to the point where they're just saying, yes, you know, there is no connection, you know, with, you know, and all of that.
Well,
now,
check
this out. But Chalabi, when he was on like a Bill Moyers show and he was confronted with some of this type of stuff, Chalabi just smiled and said, but we're in Baghdad now, aren't we?
No, I didn't know it was that cynical.
No, it's just that raw.
Well, see, Ted Koppel has this show, Nightline, and he had one of the purveyors of this lie about the weapons of mass destruction. Kind of strange interview, because he gave him a real bad time, Tracy. I was shocked, because he wasn't treating him with the kid gloves I'm used to. But I guess it's out the bag, they don't really care anymore. Like the guy said, they are in Baghdad. You know, so,
right.
But they're admitting it on some of the main media programs that they have that, and they're going to stop putting money into the, they had people searching for American citizens need to understand, they spent millions and millions and millions, possibly billions of dollars, searching for the weapons of mass destruction. Ever since they hit the ground, they had a crew of the army, the armed forces. That was their job, running around in circles, chasing their tail, trying to look busy finding the weapons of mass destruction. They just gave up on that, officially. Officially.
You know, it's also fascinating that how Yanar was talking about how there's starting to be more and more attacks and how there's polarization and stuff like that. You know, like a number of Christians have been attacked, Iraqi Christians, and some of their stores are attacked and they're stopping, you know, attacking Christians who drink wine and all of this business. Now, look, if you're a Christian in Iraq or an atheist or a Buddhist or a Sikh or anything else in Iraq, those bombs were falling on your head and your children's head by the imperialist forces just like everyone else's. So what the hell are you doing attacking some Christian or anyone else who's Iraqi, who's been suffering the same type of torment under the depleted uranium rainfall of the imperialists? See, this shows how demented this process becomes. Now, next, Yanar talks about political Islam in its development somewhat in Iraq. So let's see what she has to say. Check this out.
That is when religion is taken away from the personal side aspect of life. It is pushed into the political arena. It is used as an ID for political struggles. And this started in the last two decades after in the Middle East, and especially in the Arab world, there was a pan-Arab project. They were looking for a glorious Arab nation, and we were all driven to that. But when that failed with the invasion of Kuwait and with what Saddam did and the failure of all projects for unity between Arab countries, there were tries to look for another ID, and Islam fit in very well. And it was proving that it's the anti-American pole that all the world could look at. And what all of the world, and especially some of the traditional left, overlooked was that this political Islam had inhuman ways of handling politics, had inhuman ways of running their own societies, where women have to be marginalized, have to be oppressed, and this is what's happening in Iraq now. Islam is political. It's no more a religion, it's politics. And it's making terrorist acts all over the world, and especially on the lives of women. This is the reality that even in North America, I find that most people don't want to hear about.
So you see what's happening is that, and see, many of you listeners have heard me bring up Sudan often, because in the Sudan, much of this is what she's talking about, where the government in power in the Sudan, the NIF, National Islamic Front, is using Islam as a political tool to smash up the predominant non-Islamic people of the South. Now, these are indigenous people in the South who have been there basically since the birth of humanity. We're talking about Nubia. We're talking about people who were building pyramids in Nubia alongside the Egyptians. There's more pyramids in Nubia than there is in Egypt.
Today.
Today. The first form of pharaonic lineage took place in Nubia. The first forms of hieroglyphic writing, Nubia. Many of the first Egyptians migrated out of Nubia. Scorpion and people like that, Osiris, or real name Asar, on and on and on. My whole point is that when Islam under the Arabs came crashing into the Sudan after the conquest of Egypt by the Arab Islamic movement, an Islamic Islamicization process started to take place, and you've had resistance against it, and then the British imperialists came and kind of put a buffer over it because they had their intentions and stuff like that. But now you have the issue where the rulers in a cartoon want to basically dominate the land and the region of the whole of the Sudan. Now, if you have a people with their own indigenous historical connection to the land, their own language, so on and so forth, then often you have a different cultural aesthetic that goes outside of the ruler's dimension and their version of history. See, in other words, it's still about land, but you have indigenous people who are saying, look, we have indigenous rights and connections and our own form of self-determination to this land. So you want to then conquer them, and one of the ways that you can get the masses of the people who have turned into Muslims, who wouldn't be running over there to lose their arms and limbs against people who have been indigenous to that region, is if you mix in some form of Islamic justification. So, in part, what you have is a situation where you see people justify the religion or justify the conquest via through the whole religion, and the people in the rulers in Khartoum who have imposed the Sharia law, they tried to impose it over the whole of the Sudan. Now, of course, large portions of the population saying, no, we're not going for it. Then they can get their portion of the population as Muslim and then go over in this kind of Islamic conquest type of thing for the whole of the greater Sudan in the name of Allah, all of that type of stuff,
yeah.
Going back. Now, the rulers in Khartoum, for them, it's really about land. But they know that they can't rally the troop unless they develop a form of manifest destiny.
Yeah.
Which is similar to what happened to the conquest of the Indians. The average person is not going to go all the way over to Dakota and try to fight Crazy Horse and Two Moon for no reason at all, you know, in some territory that's considered Indian territory. But if they have instilled in them this whole manifest destiny, you know, like we're destined and we're under the flow of God and all of that type of rhetoric, then they can get mentally entrapped in that stuff. Now, the rulers in Sudan, just like in the U.S., for them it was about land. It was about control, economic order and stuff. But they couldn't just blatantly say that because they would be exposed as the hypocrites that they are. So they helped ferment this type of stuff. Now, political Islam was basically developed by Jamal al-Din al-Afghani. He was an Iranian, and he argued for pan-Islamic movement. But he was anti-socialist, communist, you know, all that type of stuff. But what ended up happening is in later in Egypt, since he was kind of an isolationist and an elitist and didn't call upon the mass movement, he expected the elitist to lead the troops. Basically, what you ended up having were a number of a mass movement developed in Egypt, but it ended up failing. And in its failure, over a period of time, you had the development of, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and other forms of that apparatus more or less take place. He was the originator of this, you know, like political Islam movement. Now, next, Yanar talks about...
Just one second before you continue. People should know this process is also taking place in Nigeria. All right? So it's happening why? In part, one of the reasons is Islam has presented itself to the world with some success among the oppressed, including this country, as a militant alternative to Christianity. So a lot of brothers, good brothers here, really believe that Islam is like, you know, that's the black man's religion, you know? And they've kind of moved away from the NOI and started becoming Orthodox Muslims, feeling that, you know, this is the real thing. And we don't play. That's what Malcolm did. Malcolm left that shit and got with, you know, boo, 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 woo, 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 you know, and it becomes a thing where illusions are generated and strengthened, that, you know, Islam itself is more militant, and this is how you fight the white man, and this kind of stuff. And, well, it ain't true.
And even though, you know, like Malcolm, you know, believed that your religion was personal. And that's why he started the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And then, as he always stated, he had his other organization, the Organization of Afro-American Unity, for the political side of it. So he saw it as two distinct things. The other thing is that there's an Afemi, you know, Fela's son, he was asked in an interview about what were some of his favorite songs by his father. And he mentioned one song where basically he said the reason why is because it helps show the destruction and detriment.
Which song was that?
The destruction and detriment that Islam and Christianity have done to African people. And he talked about how in Nigeria, for example, you basically can't get a job unless you're either Muslim or Christian.
Mm.
Muslims dominate the north, Christians in the south. Now, this a lot has to do with, if you look at the African continent, much of the north has been Islamistized, more or less. And that has to do with the Arabic Islamic slave trade that preceded the Christian transatlantic trades, slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of Africans were extinguished during the Islamic slave trade. And it helped divide the African continent in many ways on religious grounds where it had not been before. One of the largest slave revolts in the history of black struggle actually took place in a place that is now called Iraq. It was by the Zanj. The Zanj had a slave revolt that lasted about 15 years.
Mm.
It took Arabs from all around the region to go and help quell the continuous slave revolt by the Zanj. One of the aspects that the reason why you don't see the same type of large diaspora in the Middle East, black diaspora, is because of how the slave trade took place under the Islamic slavers. In the transatlantic slave trade, we were more in an agricultural mode. Brazil, you know, Cuba, North America, the Caribbean, Jamaica, da 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 da. Whereas women during the Islamic Arabic slave trade were primarily used as concubines and cooks, and they did not have control at all to be able to reproduce in many times with other black males. Whereas a large segment of the black males were turned into eunuchs. They were radically castrated. Now, if you're a eunuch, even if you adopt Islam later on and have all this prestige, you can't reproduce because you've been castrated. And for every one little boy that was, because they did it to little boys, for every one little boy that survived the process of being radically castrated, 250 died. So if you had 50,000, if you had 200 little eunuch boys, it took 50,000 to produce it. So it took a large toll on the population. And this is not even talking about the capture, where, you know, many were killed, then the long travel throughout, you know, different regions to get to some of these slave trade posts. Then the other blacks were primarily used as soldiers. And this helped expand the Islamic imperial conquest throughout the region and into India, you know, because, you know, it spread in the same way, in many ways, that the Christian crusades spread. If you were a soldier, a slave soldier, once again, your mortality rate goes up. You know, we're not talking about one of the reasons why the Zanz revolt happened with such fierceness is because, unlike many other regions, the Zanz, many of the Zanz were used in an agricultural setting. So they got to set their own ideas, they worked together, you know, and all of that type of stuff. And then they started to collaborate with some of the black soldiers, and that mixture sparked. Now, what's fascinating is that many of the writings by the Arabic Islamic slavers of that period after the Zanz were very similar to, you know, many white supremacists talking about black inferiority and all of this type of stuff about the, those who were slaves who resisted against the slavers. Same old age-old story. You know, you resist against the slaver, and all of a sudden there's something psychologically wrong with you. In the 1800s, we know of those black slaves that helped try to spark slave revolts and resisted the slave masters were diagnosed through the pseudoscience of having draptiomania, as if resisting slavery meant you had some kind of biological disorder. So these are basically what I'm saying in essence is the mindset of the slaver. Now next, Yanar talks about the forces that are resisting against Sam and how Saddam started to use Islam himself as a political tool. So let's see what she says about this. Check this out.
She was Aqila al-Hashimi. She was a previous Ba'ath figure. She was a bureaucrat who served them very well at all platforms. And many people say that she is an educated woman, if we can use her in this era, in this post-war times, to forward the women's issue, although she was not a women's activist. But the story about her is that we know that the governing council were threatened by Saddam's loyalists and the other Islamist groups to be killed. But the sad story, and this shook us all, that the first one killed from the governing council was a woman, which means that the women, it gives you the feeling that the women are the most vulnerable. She was killed cold-bloodedly, and this shook us all, and it caused some insecurity for all the people in Iraq, regardless of what your political affiliation is. You have hopes for the future, although they have put us in a dark scenario, but we still try to do the political struggle to turn it into a bright future. And all this insecurity, all these assassinations, these bombings, this is not giving us a chance to organize and to get our troops in the right places.
Actually, that wasn't the excerpt I was talking about as far as, but this was the one talking about the Aqila al-Hashimi, and she was one of the three people sitting on the governing council, and she was assassinated. Now, what's interesting is that she was not like she's not like Yanar, who is really a secularist and, you know, very conscious and so on and so forth. In many ways, Hashimi kind of was in the same mode in defending some of the whole concepts of some of the rigid codes of the traditional belief, or not, I shouldn't say traditional belief systems, but one thing she said was take honor killings. He goes, they only exist to protect the family. Now, that may sound crazy, but it's simply a question of culture. So, you know, I mentioned before how, you know, some of this honor killing, you know, some woman getting raped or something like that, or a woman trying to marry someone that she wants to marry, and then the family feeling they're being dishonored. So if she was one that was shot, you know, you could tell that some of these forces that the U.S. has helped unleash are really starting to take a stranglehold, and many of the women in Iraq are the first to be the most serious cannon fodder of it. Now next, this time Ynar talks about the forces that are resisting, you know, little Sam's invasion, the different forces. And she goes into, though, how Saddam himself started to dabble into some of this political Islam type of stuff for his own vested interests. Check this out.
I would say that because it has all the military capabilities, it's mostly Ba'ath loyalists. But then again, that's not the only ammunition for this resistance. The Islamists are giving it a very good part, a very good push. And then again, there are the remains of the Arab nationalist groups coming from all of over the Arab countries through the borders and joining forces. So it's an Islamist nationalist movement that are joining with the Saddam loyalist groups. I would be exaggerating if I would say they're all one group. I would say there are many groups working on the ground, but there is sort of a collaboration between them. And I wouldn't say Saddam was totally against the Islamists, because in the last 10 years that I left Iraq for 10 years, and after I went back, I saw that he had totally flirted with the Islamists. There are some spots in Baghdad where he's built mosques that you cannot miss from 10 kilometers. It's there to prove itself, to impose on all the, I would say, secular-based society that Islam is there to rule. And for us, Islam has been a religion. Why does it need to impose itself as a political message? And Saddam did give incredible airtime to religious programs. And he did work on the Islamization of society, part of which was the campaign of the beheadings of women, if you've heard of it. The faithfulness campaign in the fall of year 2000, he had his Fidaiyin troop collaborating with what was called the Iraqi Union for Women. It was supposed to be an Iraqi women's group. They worked together. They looked for a list of honorless women, which were assumedly prostitutes. Some of them were just political activists. They went to their houses, caught them, beheaded them, and hung them upside down in front of their houses as an example of getting rid of the evil in the society, just like another witch hunting that was done.
Now, basically, what happened was, you know, Saddam was in a certain form of crisis, and what ends up happening is that, look, you start to have social movements start to stir. So what has typically happened, like even with the Wahhabis and stuff, they can use their religion as a justification to ban secularist operations, unions, and things like that, and put it under the guise of it being un-Islamic. See, this is one of the dangers of getting caught up in these whole types of movement, thinking that they're just some kind of message from, you know, some invisible man or whatever. The U.S. rulers in the 1950s, 40s and 50s, when much of the U.S. working class were, you know, rumbling a little bit, they often complained that the U.S. working class needs to concern itself more with issues of religion as opposed to concerning itself with wages, working hours, things of that particular nature. See, at one time, there were hundreds of union papers that talked about not just union affairs, but talked about world affairs from a class perspective. And these helped, like in the working class in South Africa, give a more healthy dose to the population about what is and what is not in your interest. Is the Kobe case important? Or is mad cow disease important?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the rulers and their corporate media outlets would have you believe that it's the Kobe case that's important, not the food that you put in your body, not the fact that, yes, they're still feeding cows blood from other cows, which is where prions can exist, and fat of other animals. You know, so if they can hypnotize you and get you off the cut, and have you worrying about does someone believe in the same invisible man that you believe in, well, then they got you.
They got you. Now I want to just give you a concrete example, folks, of how this religion has been used in my own experience. I ran for the school board in 1996 with the backing of the OEA, the Oakland Educational Association, which is the teachers' union. And, of course, as part of the strike that was going on at that point, the teachers were looking for a raise and, you know, improving their situation. And Reverend Alfred J. Smith, Reverend Love Money, from Allen Temple, attacked the teachers and said, what we got here is all these teachers, they don't live here. They don't live among us. And they try to get all this money, and they ain't teaching our children nothing. Blah, 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 blah. Well, it came to my attention that Alfred J. Smith himself lived in Rodeo. So at one of the rallies, I just said, well, I have to share some information with y'all about the Reverend, the good Reverend Love Money. And I explained to people, look, he's stacking the teachers for not living here. Well, some do, some don't, but that's not demanded that you live in the city of Oakland or work in Oakland. What are you talking about? This is crazy. I said, and heaven only knows in which God he can trust, talking that kind of madness. And you know them people call me godless. They attack me and call me godless. Well, imagine that.
Next, Yanar talks about what she sees as some of the solutions for the Iraqi women and people. So let's see what she has to say. Check this out.
This should not happen to us, and it should be fought against, and who are our enemies? And pointing the finger very clearly at them. And I was also telling about the future that we do not want to see, and I was an anti-war, one of the anti-war figures. I was very well known to be that, although many of the traditional left platforms did not want to have me around because I spoke against political Islam as the future that we don't want to see in Iraq. The solution is to provide a healthy atmosphere of a healthy political atmosphere for Iraqi people to organize for a minimum time of 1 year, and that needs security and stability. And as long as the U.S. troops are in there, there is no security, no stability. As you know, the U.S. troops are the magnet for terrorists coming from all over the world to attack them. Why should we sacrifice our cities to turn into a battlefield, fierce battlefield? As long as the U.S. troops are there, we are not seeing any stability. We cannot organize. We cannot see a bright future for ourselves. The U.S. troops have to leave. You would ask me what could replace them, because it could mean a civil war. What we have said until now was a replacement by the United Nations peacekeeping group, because peacekeeping forces, because that is the only alternative, the only troops that are as big, and they are not as involved in killing Iraqi people. I do not see any other alternative for the time being, but I definitely know that we need the security and stability to be able to organize, and it has to be arranged without the U.S. troops staying in there.
Well, there you have an idea of the house of chaos that Sam has created. And sisters like Inar are the ones who end up being the most vile recipient of these types of chaos that the empire creates. We're running a little bit out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that and deal with her and some of the other things she said at another time. But hold on a sec.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and here's your Making It Plain News Service. First up, Israeli soldiers who was arrested over the so-called sniper shooting of unarmed British peace protester has been arrested. This was kind of a tragedy. You've had a number of people going to Israel in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And British peace protester Thomas Horndahl was one. He was shot in the head. They tried to lie, his commanders included, and say that he had on, the kind of military garb that would lead you to think he's a soldier. But apparently that has not worked. Also, in Israel, there has been mass resistance recently to the apartheid wall in Israel. I saw pictures of it, and I must say it were hundreds and hundreds of people out there demonstrating, and not just demonstrating, but tearing down the wall. And another very interesting fact about this action is that they were Palestinians and Israelis fighting together. Since the bourgeois media has began to not report how many people are being killed in Iraq, we felt it important to kind of give an honorable mention to this matter. As of January the 7th, the Department of Defense has identified, we know, 486 American service members who have died since the start of the war. It confirmed the death of the following Americans this past week: Dennis Corral, 33, sergeant from Nebraska; Luke P. Brisk, 20 years old, a specialist, Army Reserve; and Kalawuda Eric Palawuda, 23 years old, a captain from Texas. Just in case people might have remembered, the principal who invited the police to the school for the drug raid, well, he's history. This principal who invited the police into Goose Creek, South Carolina High School on November 5th for a drug raid that included drawn guns put to the head of children and a drug-sniffing dog, has resigned from his position. Good riddance. But that's not a... You know, they're cracking down on young people generally in school, and it's getting out of hand. I know there are problems. Of course there are. But people seem to be losing the little bit of sense we might have had before. So, for instance, a young girl was recently arrested in school for the crime of what? Breaking the dress code. She came to school in one of those little, you know, shirts when you wear your dungarees, and the little tummy, you can see the little nipple, you know, the little belly button, rather. And, you know, that's just the way people, you know, their little style. So the principal brought the young girl into her office and told her, gave her a sweatshirt and told her to put it on. The child refused to do so. They called the mother. The mother came in. The child still refused to do so. One would think they may have sent the child home, but she was arrested on the spot, handcuffed and taken to the police station. I have to, you know, we better think about what that means. When we talk about the criminalization of our youth, I never dreamt that anything like this might be in store for us. And now this. There was a rally and a hearing to stop the state administrator's Randolph Ward's attempt to close Oakland schools. Earlier in the month, in December, he had claimed that he was going to shut down 13 schools in Oakland. So yours truly showed up just to see what was going to happen. The rally got started a little late, but it picked up real quick after it's supposed to start at 4, but you know, people at work. So around by 5 o'clock, when people started getting out of work, after 5, people started showing up, and the crowd started swelling. And I met many parents from the schools that were slated to be shut down and other schools. And pleasantly surprised to see a lot of youngsters out there concerned about this. A lot of young people. This is good, because they understand that they're being attacked. So basically what happened was, this administrator, who is not accountable to anyone except his masters in the state, locked the people out. They let some people into the meeting and then they arbitrarily locked the door, trying to claim that the building was overcrowded and that there were no more room for people to sit down. That's simply not true. I was there. I went in the building for a while. I saw about 150 people go into the room. There was still room. They have a room that can hold 500 or more people upstairs. So they could have moved the meeting if they wanted people to be able to speak their piece, to protest this, to communicate with this school director. No, nothing of the sort took place. They simply locked the doors and put 12 cops out there thinking that they would intimidate people. For a while, I thought the people was going to bum rush the police, because I'm telling you, they went up the stairs and a little wrestling match took place. But they kind of calmed, things kind of calmed down, and we just basically had a rally out there, people explaining why it is they don't want their children, schools, to be shut down. So for instance, now this is something I didn't really think of. Sometimes you don't know, you know, how other people are living. Because I always keep a car, because, you know, the kind of industry working in construction, you have to always have a car. A lot of people pointed out that, look, they got 7-year-old kids, 8-year-old kids, and if they shut the school down, the next school, the closest school is 20 blocks. And I said, I didn't really get that, but you know what? Would you want your 7 or 8-year-old son, daughter, or nephew to go 20 blocks to walk to school? There is no, you know, school busing system in Oakland. And the parents pointed out that AC Transit has began to cut back certain routes. So it's not a simple matter necessarily to get your child to school. And I'm going to tell you something else. Some people pointed out that they're on limited incomes and they can't afford the bus pass. So the child would walk to school. Well, I don't know if I'd want my child to walk 20 blocks to school. That's a substantial distance, y'all. But more importantly, these schools are being shut down not because there ain't no money. Let's get away from that. They just built a damn prison. But I don't even know. It's obscene how much they pay for these things these days. They got money. The question is, what are we going to use the money for? Oh, yes. That's the real problem. So the Education Not Incarceration Coalition led the rally. And I must say, I was invigorated by it. Watching these young people out there, the confrontation with the police, which I was happy was bloodless, but real. And thus, you know, the revealing of this consciousness that is growing in Oakland. It's on, y'all. This is not over, hardly over. Educators, students, parents, concerned community members must act now to save our school, to stop State Administrator Randolph Ward and his plan to shut down these 13 Oakland schools. I learned something else. You know, you learn by participating, folks. I was out there and somebody gave me a leaflet that I read, and you know what it said? Randolph Ward is a member of the American Independent Party. So y'all say, oh, Gerald, what are you trying to prejudice us against the man participating in politics? No, I just want to educate you. The American Independent Party was started by George Wallace in Alabama, the man that said segregation now, segregation forever, in 1968 in his bid for the presidency. Then it kind of transmogrified into this right-wing populist, ultra-libertarian, anti-big government party. Let me give you an example of two of the planks in their program. This party opposes federal taxes, period. Anti-tax. They also oppose the school system. They say the school system should, the Department of Education should be wiped out, and school should be a private matter. You send your kid if you want to. The struggle for public education was much more than that, y'all. It's something we unfortunately take for granted. And that's why we're slow, you know, out the holster here to defend our rights, our right to our children to go to school. It's actually up for grabs right now, y'all. And if we don't respond, heaven help us all. The 13 schools that he wants to shut down are Burbank Elementary, Burkhalter Elementary, Emerson Elementary, Foster Elementary, Golden Gate Elementary, the school that my kids went to, Howard Elementary, John Sweet Elementary, Longfellow, right across the street from my house. In fact, I did some work in Longfellow. I installed the heating system. They had no heating system in the school for years. So we just made them break down and put some heaters in the classroom for the children. And now they want to shut the school down. Santa Fe Elementary. Actually, a pretty nice school. Toller Heights Elementary. Washington Elementary, Carter Middle School, and King Estates Middle School. Some of these schools recently won awards for improved academic performance. He wants to shut all these schools down. Building a mass campaign now to defend our schools can put a brake on Ward's attack. The schools slated for closure are small with large proportions of black students. Many parents want their kids to go to smaller schools. This is what, you know, previous administrators said was a solution to our educational problem. The budget crisis in Oakland and the state cannot be solved off the backs of black and other minority students. School closures would also lead to increased overcrowding in other schools, layoffs, and even more cuts. So this is a struggle we're going to have to pay close attention to, Tracy.
Also, this is an attack on a lot of the teachers' unions and stuff. And they actually talk about them seeing it that particular way. You've had various people use this, like Rove Norquist, who's the head of the American for Tax Reform, so on and so forth. His position is that one is good for a tactical reason against the Democrats, which many of these teachers support and all of that, because it, quote, school choice reaches right into the heart of the Democratic coalition and takes people out of it. See, what he's talking about is that all this voucher system and privatization stuff, they're calling it choice when in actuality it's really no choice, and, you know, and all of that. But it's a way of weakening the teachers' union, one, because you're taking people out of the public sector and you get money off of, you know, how many students go. And then two, it fractures the Democratic Party. So many of these strategists have complained about, like, Terry Moreau, who's a senior fellow of the conservative Hoover Institution, co-author of the book Politics, Markets, and American Schools. She talked about how the various power of these teachers' unions and says that they have, quote, a lot of money for campaign contributions and for lobbying. They also have a lot of electoral clout because they have many activists out in the trenches in every political district. No other group can claim this kind of geographic, uniform political activity. They are everywhere, unquote. So weakening the teachers' union is one way of undermining the power.
Exactly. And just to substantiate what Tracy just said, this is not just rhetoric. Ward plans to rent shut down schools to charter schools. He is a privatizer. You see, we have better wake up on this question of public facilities and commonly owned facilities, because actually it's very important. They're going to have you paying for every damn thing if they have their way. Keep the schools public. Keep the public schools open. It starts now. Defend the Oakland schools. That's all right now for the Making It Plain News Service. Tracy?
Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slade tonight. That's just becoming clear and clear that what we're going to have to grind for, fight for, die for, and if necessary, yes, kill for, is true equal rights and justice. Until the next time, slave vote.
Crying out for peace, yes. None is- justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yeah. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. None of them want to die. I don't want no peace. I might need equal rights and justice. I got to get it. Equal rights and justice. I really need it. Equal rights and justice. Give them my shit. Equal rights and justice. What is due to Caesar? You better give it on to Caesar. And what belongs to I? You better give it up to I. 'Cause I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I've got to.